Welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast. I'm your host, Ruth Fittock, and today we're asking, what does it really mean to be exit ready? And what happens after the ink dries on the deal? In this episode, I'm joined by Rhys Harvey, CEO at Oceansaver, who shares a rare behind-the-scenes look at life inside multiple acquisitions, from pop chips to Plenish. We dive into gross margin myths, why repeat rate is underrated, and how brands can stay true to their mission while scaling. If you're building a challenger brand or have an eye on an exit, this one's full of hard-won insights.
Hi, Rhys, thanks for coming on today. It's great to see you. Before we get into it, it'd be great to hear a bit more about you, your background, and how you got to where you are now.
Thanks for having me on. So, yeah, I mean, I started out my career in audit of all places. So I did 4 years in audit where I specialised in manufacturing and retail businesses. But I think 90% of auditors, that's never really the dream. It's only ever a stepping stone to bigger and better things. I've always had a passion in sort of tangible products, whatever that may be, whether it be food and drink is probably what I enjoy the most. And so when the pop chips opportunity came knocking back in 2014, I think we were probably in a coffee shop that doesn't exist anymore. It seemed like the obvious next step for me career-wise. And I think they say the rest is history. And yeah, that was 11 plus years ago. And I've really found myself fallen into roles, I would say, rather than had a sort of map of career path out in front of me. Taking jobs I was definitely not qualified to do along the way, but always found a way to work it out. Had some sort of great mentors along the way to help me through that journey. And yeah, now I'm the CEO of Oceansaver.
Nice. I remember I was part of your job interview for Pop Chips. I can remember.
You were. Yes. Yeah. Oh, it seems so long ago.
Well, it was. That's why. So we've worked together twice now at Pop Chips and Simply Roasted. And in between that, you also worked at Plenish and steered that brand through its acquisition by Britvic, and also steered the Pop Chips acquisition through to KP Snack. So I thought it'd be good to talk about exits today, because I know that for a lot of brands, startup scale-ups, obviously, the exit is the thing that everyone has half an eye on, whether they admit it or not. What do you think is something people misunderstand about getting a brand ready to exit?
I think that people see this exit readiness as a sort of final destination, checklist of tasks you can almost work through. And you get to the end of the task list and you say, hurrah, I'm exit ready. Whereas really, I think it's a sort of either a state of mind or just this constant state of readiness. And it comes down to good fundamentals within the business. Is the brand growing? Are you attracting consumers? And I think that's really what it means to be exit ready. Because I think a lot of it is down to luck. And while I think all of us have this great plan of it's going to get to the 25th of March, 2030, and I'm going to sell on that day, but it never really happens. And when you're not looking to sell, all the offers come in. And when you are looking to sell, there's a sort of barren wasteland of offers. So I think it's about that readiness rather than an actual, can I tick through these things that say I'm going to exit at the end of the day. I would encourage businesses to really concentrate, and bias being from a finance background, that I do think gross margin is really, certainly over the years, probably the metric I've underappreciated that the businesses were going to look at. So always had it drummed into me that it was going to be about revenue, but actually it's really about profit. And to the point where the acquirer almost laughs in your face how small your revenue is. And they're so much better at driving revenue. So they just want to know when they flex their muscle and get it into all of the listing that they've already got, can they make money when they do that? And I think that's what it truly means to be exit ready.
What's that saying? Revenue is vanity, profit is sanity.
Exactly.
There's been a lot more about that, hasn't it, in recent years? Shift from like growth at all costs to profitability. It does feel like the newer generation of brands are a lot more focused on profitability, which feels a lot healthier, to be honest.
Definitely. And there's this conversation that always sticks in my mind with Verlinvest, who were the investors in Pop Chips. And we asked them, what metric do you want us to drive the hardest? Do you want revenue? Do you want gross profitability? Or do you want net profit down at the bottom? And they said all three. And I remember being really frustrated with that conversation, thinking I can't possibly grow all three at the same time. But I think generally people are now more conscious that they are happy to accept a lower revenue growth. You don't have to be growing triple digit, but actually that focus on gross profit, because ultimately that's what drops down all the way to some sort of profitability, hopefully. That seems to be an increasing focus, both with investors, but also with any strategic acquirers.
What do you think the early signs are that a brand might be on an exit path, even if it doesn't know it yet?
I think probably my personal favourite would be repeat rate. And I think I say repeat rate once you're of a certain scale. So say you're over £1 million of revenue. And I think being on a platform like Ocado, where you get really good access to data, even if you're a sort of very small brand, and they pride themselves on listing a lot of brands, so you can have some really good access to data. But I think if you've got that above average repeat rate, so people are coming back into your brand, and as long as you're not doing crazy things to get them back in, as long as you're not running 52 weeks of half price deals and kidding yourself that you've got this great brand, I think that is a real, real good hallmark of, have I got some of the component elements that a consumer is going to want to part with their hard-earned money for without necessarily having huge marketing budgets? I think a really good sense check that you're onto something, not just in terms of an exit, but in terms of, am I driving this brand in the right direction almost? Otherwise, if your repeat rate's on the floor, there's something I need to change probably.
Yeah. I also remember at Popchips, one of the standout things for us was that we were the highest selling crisp brand off promotion in a really heavily promoted category. And that was how we knew we were onto something there, because when something's massively promoted like crisps are, it's easy to shift a lot of volume when people are happy to pay for you at full price, more so than other brands. And that's like a real show of strength, whether it be product or brand or probably a combination of all of it.
Definitely. And I think in consumer goods especially, you see probably two big blue chip organizations really in any category, and consumers switch between those two big brands whether they're on promotion or not. And so I guess our role as consumer goods challengers is, can we convince a consumer at full price to not buy something that's cheaper? And then there is some component elements within your brand or your product that this might be a good idea. And then there's lots of other ones. If your gross margin's at sort of 50% without almost trying, that is great. But I would say that probably is a lot rarer and probably a lot harder to influence, certainly in those early days.
So you might have already answered this, but having been on the inside of multiple acquisitions, what do buyers really care about versus what founders think they care about?
I think it's quite surprising, actually, what they do care about. And I've only learned this over time, but I would say founders have an obsession over the product. And I think that's why the good ones, the good businesses that grow onto scale, it is almost that obsession that drives them. But then really, when an acquirer is coming in, and I've been in those presentations where I've probably got about 15 slides on the product, and they almost, it's not that they don't care, but they don't care in quite the same way that you care. So if you've got the finest Peruvian ginger powder in your product, you might be really passionate about that, but actually they're thinking, that's probably a bit of a cost. Is there a way I can keep all those consumers without necessarily having that in? So I think what they're really looking for is, how easily does your brand slot into their portfolio? And that's not to say that you have to almost have an identical product, but they're really saying, can we support this while we're also supporting all the other brands that we look after in quite an easy fashion? And one example where it didn't work for us was at Plenish, and we actually had three different supply chains. So we had an ambient supply chain, a chilled supply chain, and almost a direct-to-consumer supply chain. Now, you might think that we've picked the best in the business for each one of those supply chains, But when an acquirer looks at that, they're thinking, I've only got an ambient supply chain. How on earth am I going to bolt this business into my business? That's really what they cared. That's what they cared about, and probably had about 20 meetings on exactly that subject. But it's less about product. And I also think, and again, this might be a sign of the times, you assume that they're going to care about revenue, how big you are, but really what they're thinking is the revenue is almost a hygiene factor. If you're not over a certain revenue, they wouldn't have looked at you in the first place. And then those brands are excellent at driving revenue. So they almost consider that that's their job. Do they have a good brand that slots into their portfolio that they can scale? That's really what they're focused on. They'll leave sort of product and customer fit. You've almost already taken care of that by the time that they're looking at it anyway.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because both Popchips and Plenish have been successful acquisitions from the outside anyway, that those brands have continued to grow and to flourish and to continue to build out their categories. Popchips is, I think I saw some recent stats, and it's still in growth, which is amazing to see. It doesn't always happen like that. There's a lot of stories where it hasn't worked. It was also interesting with Popchips because we worked on loads of NPD and innovation. That was my job towards the end. And then we just cut all that. It's gone. It's just the core, isn't it? So it's almost that sort of obsession with product and range extensions and trying, that's going to get you where you're going. But actually the core of the brand, growing the core, if you look at brands that have been successful post-acquisition, often there's a kind of pivot back to the core. Was it the same with Plenish? Do they still do all of the chilled, complicated stuff?
I think they still do, yeah, a lot of the chilled, complicated stuff. And I think where they've had a lot of success is on the juice shots. So I think that product in particular fit quite nicely almost as a range extension within Britvic. So actually, they've taken that really from strength to strength, and we had very limited distribution on it when it was acquired, and now I think it's almost everywhere. And so the less sort of pain points you have, obviously, the easier that is, and therefore the more attractive you look as a business.
Which brings nicely on to sort of next point about getting exit ready operationally, so getting your house in order. What else do you need to be exit ready operationally?
I think systems are really underrated, and I think particularly founders who probably aren't necessarily process or system orientated, but really in the case of Popchips, it held us back. We didn't have a particularly good system. These acquiring businesses are so used to a huge range of information almost at the click of a button that they're so good at internally sharing information, probably sometimes too much information. And smaller businesses typically aren't very good at doing that. It's a lot of manual work. It's a lot, to some extent, guesswork at times, or assumptions is probably the more diplomatic way of saying that. But it's those processes. So almost every business I've ever worked with has started out life on Xero, being the accounting software. I can guarantee you, if you're trying to sell a business while still using Xero, you'll be up until 5 a.m. trying to crunch information that these big businesses will just require day by day, almost minute by minute. And that was a learning almost out of Popchips that we took into Plenish that said, actually, we probably need to overinvest ahead of our size into a system like that if we ever hope to exit. But really, it was to help us scale. And I think that exiting and scaling are almost synonymous with each other, whether you actually want to exit or not. Whatever it means to be exit ready actually also means it's definitely going to help you scale and scale at pace. So I would strongly encourage, it's probably not going to be the founder, being honest, but is your operational team, your finance team, get them to invest in a really good system, because it actually provides insight back into the business. And what it's really good at is looking at product profitability, customer profitability, which only helps sales and marketing teams hopefully put effort in the right areas within the business.
Were there any tough decisions you had to make to get the business ready to be acquired or more attractive to potential acquirers?
I think we thought we were making hard decisions at the time, but in hindsight, I actually don't think they were either tough decisions or decisions that the acquirer actually cared about. And I think NPD was a prime example of that. We thought, great, we're going to make these really tough decisions. We're going to accelerate all of these new product timelines, probably quicker than we thought was humanly possible. And then the acquirer ended up just mothballing the MPD.
Well, this is especially painful for me because I was leading that project and we were about to hit go on what I still think is a really great product, and no one's done it yet still. So might stop shopping that about. But it was gutting.
Yeah, and I think we launched Star Wars, Ridged Crisps, multi-packs, the NPD that we probably shouldn't mention because it's been mothballed. But in hindsight, most of it was a waste of time. Multi-packs was probably the main success, and I'm pretty sure I still see that on the shelves today. So that was definitely one good bit of NPD. But I actually think, having gone through that, the toughest decision is almost to stay focused, to really concentrate on the core. And I think conventional wisdom, we have it almost weekly or in board meetings, and you often get questions of, what new products are you going to launch? And so that's why I think it's actually a tough decision to say, to stand up and say, actually, we're going to really concentrate on the core. And I think if you were just to sample sort of 100 businesses, whatever sort of stage they are, and you looked actually what revenue is made up of the core part of their business, I think it would follow Pareto, and you'd be looking at sort of 70 or 80% of it most likely is in that core. But I think a disproportionate of time, money and resource is spent on MPD because they think acquirers want MPD. And I think it goes back to, can you scale outside of your core is probably what everyone's trying to answer. But I think really if your core is growing 50% year on year, you're acquiring customers, it's driving the business. I don't think any acquirer is really asking, are you going to bring out a functional crisp or a gut health drink if your core is really working?
I feel like there's a couple of things that mostly drive innovation in these sorts of businesses. It's either sort of boredom within the team of, like, you don't know that's the reason, but that is the reason if we're sick of talking about this. Or it's retailers, isn't it? So it's like going into a retailer meeting and then wanting something exclusive, or letting them drive that conversation. Or they've seen me for Pop Chips because we were a US brand. They'd see something in the US market and then they'd say they wanted it. And then we'd be like, oh, okay, they're going to list it, so we might as well do it. And there were some examples within the US business of that, where that really backfired. So bringing out a product that wasn't as good as the core, switching out core SKUs for MPD, then didn't work, then lost the facings. There's a massive risk to it, not even just with resource and energy and time and money, but it can take away from the core, not add to it if you're not careful.
Definitely. And I think MPD, there's a huge time and a place for it. And I think keeping retailers excited is definitely a part of it. But yeah, being conscious that it's only ever really going to be 20% of your business, protect the core at all costs, make sure you're supporting it with enough investment and enough time. Keep everyone interested with all the newness, but don't let it distract you. Our chairman, Ocean Saber, who was also the chairman of Plenish, drills into it and says, we will be bored long before the consumer will be bored. And I think it's remembering that even at the point you're bored, keep going for another 2 or 3 years. Only then might the consumer have heard about it for the very first time. And I think that's something that I try and remember.
I remember writing an innovation strategy for Pop Chips, and one of the slides said, fail upwards. And our boss, Will, was like, that doesn't make any sense. And I don't think I made that up. I do think that is an expression. But as the point was that we expected innovation to fail, but on the way, it would lift the brand. So whether it be we'd get some PR, we'd get a new retail listing, we'd build some relationships, but you'd expect it to fail. That was part of the strategy, because it's actually landing good MPD. And sometimes, I guess in the case of Plenish, the MPD can take over and become the core of the business. So there's that difference between pivoting or innovating when there's a trend, macro trend, or things are swinging in that direction, and that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of brands have jumped on a moment that they've seen in the market, and I think that's smart innovation. But I think innovations for innovation's sake sometimes can distract you.
I'm going to move on and talk a little bit about what happens inside an exit and that psychology of that. So as we both know, exits can be thrilling, brutal, and also just somewhat anticlimactic.
I think anticlimax is a very good way of describing it. There's probably no better way, really. And I think it's built up in as if it's almost the finish line of a race and you get to collapse. But really, I think it's remembering that the fun bit is almost the path to the exit. And normally, by the time you've actually signed on the dotted line of an exit, most people haven't slept for a couple of months. I think I was going to sleep regularly at sort of 3 a.m., working weekends, taking naps at lunchtime just to try and steal 20 minutes of sleep. And almost the bigger the acquirer, the worse it is because they hugely overcommit resource to the deal. And there's typically only two or three of you working on it in the latter stages. I think don't expect it to be this great moment. You probably won't even want to go out for a drink or a nice meal because you're just too tired. It's a bit like finishing an exam where probably you might get a bit ill immediately after because you're just so exhausted. Give it a week, go out for dinner, celebrate. It is obviously a momentous occasion, but really it's enjoy the run up. And I think it's this stage now of business that I'm in. It's the 0 to 20 million, the 0 to 30 million. That's the fun bit for me personally. And just don't chase the exit. Just make sure you enjoy the growth because that's really where the fun is. It's definitely not on signing some paperwork.
I think that's like a good strategy anyway, and I've seen loads of things about how brands can go really wrong when they're just obsessed from day one with exiting. It doesn't seem to work anyway for all of the things we've talked about, and that it's more about luck and about timing. And I think, you know, it's these mega trends that can just turn a brand around. With a lot of brands you see, they've been building in the background for years, and then suddenly the stars align and the conditions become right and they explode. I think a lot of things can go wrong when people are too obsessed on an exit.
Definitely. And I think each acquirer almost has a different reason for why they're acquiring you. And you can't possibly know that while you're building the brand. So I think you can't go too far wrong. And it's that, you know, are you building to scale the business or are you building to exit? And I think the more successful business are the ones just truly building to scale. And the exit is almost the icing on the cake at the end of the day, but it doesn't really make up the cake. Whereas I think the businesses that are so focused on exiting and, you know, you've seen when it's gone wrong and they've cut their marketing team or they've halved the marketing budget, launched some MPD, not launched some MPD, changed the factory, looking for this exit, and then the exit doesn't happen. And then they've unexpectedly sort of undermined the future survival of that business. So I think keeping scaling front of mind, I think is a much better approach. And I don't have any facts or numbers to sort of back up my theory, but I imagine those businesses will be more successful when it eventually does come to an exit.
I also think one of the weirdly brutal things about when you're going through an exit is if you've been a really tight-knit team, like we were at PopChips, there's a point where some of you know something.
It changes the dynamic, and I would not say for the better. Whereas I think if you can keep that team cohesion for as long as possible as you continue to scale, I think that's what really makes the difference. And the minute someone starts talking about, oh, are we going to sell? What's it going to be like? You're ultimately not thinking about the day job. You're thinking about something else.
And the reality is for a lot of the staff and the team who've helped build it, the exit isn't going to be particularly consequential for them. Actually, in reality, it's going to mean them losing a job that they love. And I think that's something that people should be mindful of as well. It's not great news for everyone.
Definitely. There is a bit of sadness. I would say most businesses go through at least a percentage of job losses post-acquisition. And so in doing the deal, you know that that's almost the end of a chapter in that business. And I think that was particularly true at PopChips, where a lot of people ended up leaving. I think there might even be one or two still there, but most of the team has now gone on. And I think everyone looks back on that really fondly, but it was the end of a almost an era. It is tinged with sadness, and so I think that's not to be underestimated.
It was a long goodbye as well, wasn't it, which made it hard. So it was like whole departments went one by one as the business integrated into its new owner. And I think that's the other thing, is that the exit, like you say, feel positioned as this moment where you sign on the dotted line, but often it's not like that at all. And even for founders, they might be in an earnout period, they might have to stay for a few years. And I think that's the bit that actually is really hard.
Particularly if you've got a new boss and you've been the boss, or you've reported into the boss. Now you've got sort of five or six new layers of management to report into. And even that is a transition period.
I think what we did really well at PopChips was we were scaling and we are builders was one of our brand values, which is still one of my favourite that I try and bring with me into any business I go into, because I think it's so fundamental for startups and scale-ups to have everyone have that mindset. It did feel like we all knew that was the journey we were on. So it was job done at that point.
I think there's very few huge businesses that are privately owned. So you sort of accept that this is the consumer goods brand life cycle. Challenger Brands is very good. Call it 0 to 50 million. The blue chips are very good, 50 to 500 million and plus. So there is an element, you go into it knowing that this may happen, but I think trying not to think about it too often, enjoy the journey.
Has your definition of a good exit changed?
I don't think it has, but I think because my definition of a good exit was always, does the brand live on? And if you put those financial incentives to one side, it's when this brand has been acquired, hopefully it still stands for everything you wanted it to stand for on day one. And I think in my mind, that's therefore what a really good exit looks like. And I still go down the supermarket shelves, and even if I'm not buying crisps, I'll go check in on PopChips and I'll go check in on Plenish, just because it was a really big chunk of your life. And it's just nice to see that those brands are still there, still trying to deliver the same messages. There's definite sense of pride in that. Does that brand stand for something that lives on beyond both you as an individual, but with that new owner, and hopefully make sure that they can't change any of those things that you hold dear?
You can't control that anymore, can you?
You can try. I think increasingly you're starting to see brands, particularly in the better for the planet space, trying to write certain things into the articles of the business. Not that that means that it's set in stone and you can't ever change anything, but in terms of board structure, in terms of what they want to stand for, increasingly I've started to see that be a real focal point up front, because they almost know that it will be, or they hope that it will be acquired in the future. So if you can plan from day one with that in mind, I think that's a really smart move.
So how are you bringing this experience into your Ocean Saver day-to-day running of the business?
I think I've probably learned something from, well, lots of things, but something from every business I've been at. And I've tried to cherry pick as best I can the little nuggets out of every single business. And I think certainly at PopChips, it was, took the business to sort of 20 million. We had some really good processes. We had a phenomenal team. So then at subsequent businesses, it's like, how do we from day one, we build a great team that's focused on the journey, not the eventual exit. How do we implement the processes of a 20 million pound business into a 1 million pound business where it's appropriate? Sometimes that can definitely be overkill. And I think it is always, we're just still learning. And that idea, I think particularly as you're scaling, every sort of new stage of the business, you learn something new. And what was good for you at 15 million probably won't be good for you at 20 million. I think this will be the fourth business I've been in, six including the acquiring entities. I think it would be easy to think that you've been there, done that, got the t-shirt. But I think understanding that every single business is different, you can still bring the elements of it that you thought worked really well out of the other businesses. But understanding that you still don't know anything, despite 15 years experience, I think if you go in with that sort of hunger, that challenger mindset, however long you've been in business or however successful your business is, I think that's a really good understanding. And if you can try and get the team to think like that as well, then that's brilliant. But I think time and time again, if you can hire great people with a similar attitude, I think you'll have a really good time. So I think the package, the sort of shared vision, coupled with ultimately the vision of the business. And I think if you do make the vision of the business the exit, people are over time going to be a lot less engaged. But if the vision of the business is something a lot bigger, whether it be a health mission, whether it be a planet mission, coupled with those incentives, I think keeps you invested, keeps you motivated. It's part of the reason why I'm certainly drawn to these businesses. It gives you the sense that you're working towards something bigger, and that on the tough days that it gives you the extra 2 or 3%. I'm not going to say it's a game changer, but it certainly helps when things don't necessarily go to plan. And I think if you can create that within the team, then hopefully the team share that energy.
So as I mentioned at the beginning, we've worked together a couple of times now. You're in a finance background, from a brand background, not known to work together harmoniously all the time, but I think we always have actually, which I guess is quite unusual. So I'm interested to chat about your views on brand, if only for all the other finance background people who are listening, and maybe they can learn something. You know, it's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? Because finance is often about risk management, and then building a challenger brand often requires making some big, bold bets. How have you balanced those?
I think you're spot on, and I think those two departments don't often see eye to eye. Been witness to a few wisecracks at both of those departments' expense. But I think probably the interaction between those two departments is almost misunderstood, and misunderstood even sometimes by people that work in those departments. And I think sometimes they're seen as enemies. But actually, I think when you can join the two together, they're actually even stronger. And I think they almost operate a bit like a yin and a yang, that really you'll get the best out of both of those groups of people if hopefully, and I say hopefully, they can see eye to eye. And I think particularly, I'm talking from sort of finance experience, that the finance department's always seen as the no people, the people without the ideas, the people that just crunch the numbers. But really, and certainly from my perspective, I'm thinking, how can I make this idea a success? And that's what I bring to the table. I might not bring the idea itself, but I can certainly hopefully breathe life into that idea and give it every possible chance of success. And one example, particularly in Ocean Saver, but we had this beautifully designed bottle, work of art, belonged in some sort of design museum. Brilliant idea. The only problem, it didn't fit down a manufacturing line. So went off and produced all these glorious bottles that then couldn't actually be filled. And I think that's one example where you do need a healthy dose of both departments. You need to keep the core of that beautiful idea, that design, but you need to inject in a hint of practicality, not to say no and just kill the project from the outset, but say, how can I make sure that this is a success? Because ultimately, I think deep down, you know that for the most part, people are ultimately working for the good of the business. Saying no all the time isn't very useful, and coming up with loads of ideas that don't see the light of day also isn't useful. So I think it's that healthy combination of those two departments where they actually work at their best.
I think it goes a bit back again to that shared vision, doesn't it? It's like one team, one dream, you're all on the same page. I think it comes to healthy respect for everybody else. And I do think the benefit of being in brands early stage and then scaling with them and growing with them is you get to understand other departments in a way that you don't if you join straight away when you're at 20 million. You know, you're a lot more siloed, even though that's still a relatively small brand. So I feel like that startup experience is really valuable for that. And it's a bit like when people think that sales and marketing don't work well together. And it's like, it's the same thing. You know, we're all doing the same job. They should be your best friend. Both those departments should be best friends, because marketing is supporting sales. And I feel lucky that all of the salespeople I've worked with, that's always how it's been. And then I've sort of witnessed some other bigger businesses often where they're kind of at loggerheads, which feels bizarre.
I think it's, you know, we work for consumer goods brands. So it almost feels impossible not to have that sense of brand in whatever department you work in. but I can definitely see why in bigger businesses where you might work for almost a conglomerate that you don't feel quite as invested. And so you are a bit more siloed. You might only be rewarded on your own KPIs, but I almost think that's what smaller businesses do really well, that, you know, quite often we all share one target. And so it's in everyone's best interest to get along. You're ultimately there to try and grow the brand and further the mission. So it almost feels counterintuitive, and maybe I'm lucky because I've spent most of my career in those smaller businesses. But yeah, you are working towards that common goal, and you're all ultimately trying to do the same thing.
I think there's a bit in there as well about bringing other people on the journey, right? It's like if you're doing something or changing something, putting the time in to properly explain it cross-functionally of why you're doing it, and often that can make all the difference, even with the sort of wackiest, most risky marketing initiative. Then you take the time to sell it back into the business, which is a great skill to have anyway, because you're going to need that whatever level that you're at. The more senior you get, the more you spend your time selling things into people above you, whether they be investors, CEO, whoever. Taking the time and having the patience to explain properly the reasoning behind the perceived madness, or this is a risk that we're taking and this is what we're doing to mitigate it, these are the other things that we're doing that are less risky, often that can be all it needs to bring people along with you. And the same thing with finance initiatives, I guess, as well. And then everybody else gets a better grounding in why the business is doing what it's doing.
Definitely. And the empathy and understanding that businesses that work best have different ideas and different perspectives on the same point or objective, and that's when they are at their best. So almost celebrate that. I think empathy goes a long way, particularly when working in departments that traditionally finance can be siloed at times. So trying to see it from other people's perspectives, I think, goes a long way. And I've been fortunate enough to work in a lot of different departments, whether it be commercial, whether it be a really good working relationship with marketing, whether it be operational, and you do understand those pain points from a different perspective.
So you've seen challenger brands that scale fast, also some that stall out. What do you think separates the ones who break through from the ones who burn out?
I think there are a lot of great brands out there. And sometimes, even in the success stories, you do look and you sort of say, how on earth did they make it? And there's some great brands that didn't make it. And you're asking yourself, why didn't they make it? And I think, therefore, for me, it comes down almost to the execution within the business. And I think all of these brands have all got great ideas. I think you looked at them and there is at least an element where you're saying from the outset, there is at least a chance that this brand could succeed and go all the way. But I think it's in that execution, it's staying true to the original vision. And I've certainly been in businesses where that vision has changed almost month by month. And that's when it's very difficult to execute something that's ever changing. Even back to my audit days, there was a phrase that you can't audit a moving target. And so there's a bit like that within businesses, that if the strategy and the vision's always changing, it's very hard to execute and you almost undermine the great idea that you actually had. So it's not to say that you should pick one strategy and even when you see it failing miserably, that you stick to it no matter what over the edge of the cliff. But it's certainly saying that a lot of these great ideas and strategies and visions need a good couple of years to actually determine whether they are good or bad. So I think if you can give it that time, that focus, staying true to the vision that you ultimately set the business up on, that I think those are the more likely businesses that are going to succeed. And I think I look to a business like Dash, and I think they are wonky fruit infused sparkling water. And that's what they've always stood for. It's what they stand for today. They could go into CBD. They could go into prebiotic drinks, but they really stayed true to that vision. And I think that's in part why that business is so successful, because they've really had that North Star and really stuck with it. So I think it's have a strong vision and stick to it would be where I've seen the most success, really.
Don't change your strategy every couple of months when you start to.
Or it gets hard. It's if it isn't hard, you know, no business is easy. So you have to know how to weather those hard times. But that first speed bump you hit, don't change strategy or don't change your vision.
And what's your vision for Ocean Saver?
Our business vision is to save ocean life from single-use plastic and harmful chemicals. But I think what that means more tangibly is we want to rid the household aisle of single-use plastic. And we think we will be definitely a part of that, but we almost want to be a catalyst for change. And I think we admire the blue chips for so many reasons, and we're up against P&G, Unilever, some fairly monumental consumer goods brands. But if we can hopefully nudge them in the right direction to cut out a lot of that single-use plastic, then I think that's really going to be a hallmark of whether Ocean Saver's done a really good job or not. And it may be slightly naive in thinking that we're going to be able to do that. But yeah, I think we're already starting to see little nuggets, and definitely material innovation, chemical innovation, just the eco movement as a whole, I think is really going from strength to strength. So despite operating in household goods, it's actually a really exciting and fun place to work.
Some people think crisps isn't that exciting. How we beg to differ.
Madness, absolute madness.
So final question we ask everyone, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
I think a brand of tomorrow has a really well-rounded team, I think, with different skill sets, different styles, different opinions, with a healthy dose of arguments within there. And I think if you can couple that with a really clear vision of where you want that business to be, I think that's really what makes a brand of tomorrow.